money and forgot, and I'm out. Oh, I'm just kidding. That's a joke. My name's Eric D. I'm a recovered alcoholic. I'm very grateful to be here in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. Above all that, I'm most grateful for the power I have in my life for keeping me sober today, and that's the power of God, the higher power that I found in this program to save my life. It's a privilege and an honor to be asked to speak. I'd like to thank Bill and everybody that put this meeting together. It's been an amazing experience for me so far. There was a good workshop where I got to see Teddy and Stephanie speak. So anybody that was there knows that there was a lot of power in seeing what our first step looked like. And, you know, I fall into that category of the hopeless alcoholic. Let me get this thing up again. But I just couldn't stay sober on my own power, you know, and I had to find a program. And above that, I had to incorporate something that would keep me sober for good and all. And I'm grateful that I found that today. You know, I've got a God-given sobriety date, October 25th of 2011. You know, that took me just shy of 2 years of sobriety. And that's night and weekend too. And it's also, we're in AA, you know, and I know a lot of my people here from the homes, and, you know, I'm a proud product of Pine Recovery as well. I came to our home, and so it was an amazing spot for me to recover, you know, and I got connected to a home group when I was in Pine Recovery, and that's the primary purpose group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And by combining this, we got people representing both groups here, and I don't think it matters what specific group you're a part of, but do you have one, and have you found a home, and have you found a place where people are getting well and seeking God, you know, and I was just absolutely blessed with that experience. You know, I was blessed to find a spot when really nobody wanted to have anything to do with me, because I tried getting sober on my own terms, and it just didn't work. I don't know if anybody can relate with that, but, you know, like we were talking about in the workshop, I was the alcoholic of the hopeless variety, right? I was this guy who, man, everybody was cheering for, and I had a lot of potential, but it just seemed like the booze was getting in the way, you know? And from the beginning, I didn't really chase the booze. I like going to the parties, you know? I like playing music, and I like that type of stuff, but at some point in my drinking experience, the alcohol began to take precedence over any other thought I was having. So meaning that I would go to the party at first to socialize and be normal, but after a while I just cared if they had, you know, how much heat and light they had at the end of that. I was seeking the booze instead of the advantage experience, the human experience. I'm blessed today, you know. I say I'm a recovered alcoholic, and that's my truth. And I don't really look at myself so much as an alcoholic anymore as recovered. I'm simply a child of God who's just getting a little bit more free every day. And that's the truth, you know. And the home I went through and the incorporating the book and the program that's outlined for us in our home, in the best fellowship there is, man. We joke around because there's so many A's talking about the acronyms before. I like the little stand-up comedy before the meeting tonight, right? I was kind of breaking the ice, but, you know, there's so many A's. I talk about this in some of the groups I run. You know, there's AA, NA, GA, CNA, CA. You know, they're the ones David Luper talked about, nicotine anonymous. But what's the point? The point is the steps work. Steps work. And really the message I'm trying to carry tonight is just that, to the still suffering alcoholic. And I don't care if you've got 20 minutes sober, 20 days, 20 months, 20 years. You know, I've been blessed with the message that it set me free from alcohol for good and all. I know it in the heart. You know, and it's an amazing experience. Not only free from that, but free from some of those other A's. You know, I'm a member of some other fellowships, but this is the coolest fellowship in the world. Nothing beats Alcoholics Anonymous. Am I right? I feel like I'm on an infomercial up here. I don't know. Can you tell me about your experience today? Anyway, but my experience was that I had tried many times, and I've been kind of in and out of previous centers, and I've even had some experience with AA and coming to meetings and doing the work a little bit. But the thing is, when I look at it, as an alcoholic, I find myself to be someone who doesn't want to conform very easily, and I always kind of thought I was the exception. I thought that these other people had to work the steps and do those things and practice things like complete and entire abstinence, but I was somewhat different. You know, that I could maybe just not drink, but take some pills, you know, or I could, 12 steps was suggested, but 3 is just a lot more comfortable because that inventory process just seems a bit much. You know, or maybe you can give me the solution, but I don't know how to give it away. And that, I think, was the true downfall of anything that I've ever done since I've been blessed with God's grace and being sober, was taking things back in a selfish manner. Because I heard someone speak the other night, and I really liked it. I kind of just passed that on. That the root of my trouble is truly my selfishness, and that flame still burns, and it always will burn. Alcohol just sort of, you know, lift that flame and make it show to a degree that was really painful, you know. God separated me in the Vicelia Rescue Mission in October, like I said, of 2011, and I surrendered completely and utterly to His grace. From that moment, I knew I was set free, but there was still action to be done. I was blessed, like I said, with a bed and this treatment center, man, where I actually work out today. It's a true gift, but, you know, a lot of us get a little bit of time in a home, and I know there's some women from the home who like to speak directly to you and those of you who are suffering there in their homes that we talked about in the workshop earlier, this voice, the spiritual voice. And what it talks about on page 30 of our big book is conceding to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics. And I never knew what that meant. I would get some grace, I would land in these treatment centers, but I surely never knew what it meant to concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. Because I'd been to meetings. You know, I stood at podiums like this, and I talked to my sponsor, and I definitely called my family, and that's the first thing we do when we get sober. I don't know about you guys, but I want to call everybody in the car on the phone and say, I'm sober, man, but they're still holding me at arm's distance, like we talked about. You know, they don't trust me because time and time again, I seem to hurt the people that I love the most, you know, and it's painful to go through, and you guys know what I'm talking about. Those of you with the real variety. But the innermost self that I was defined, like I talked about on page 30, was sort of right here at the gut level. This was where I had this void that nothing could fill but the whiskey, you know, the vodka, right where it burnt. That spot, and nothing made it go away except for the alcohol. And when I quit drinking, I don't know about you guys, but when they take the alcohol away from me, I get a little bit worse. You know, I was kind of pissed off when I was in the treatment center because it seemed like after the guys, you know, would lift some weights, you know, and get some sloppy joes in them, like things would get back, you know, and they would be making phone calls and things would be getting better, but I found myself isolated and driven by things like depression and misery, and I just wasn't getting better. I was defined that the same spiritual void that I had deep down in my gut was the same place that God resides. And I went to my room where I was staying in that treatment center, and I fully conceded for the first time that I was going to need God's power to keep me separated from alcohol. And from that decision, and the first step, it wasn't really a decision. You know, I know that I lost the power of choice and control, all control. And I really wish, you know, people ask me, man, sometimes I go out, you know, when I'm out, people ask me, Eric, you can't just have one drink, can't you just have one? You've been sober over 2 years, you know, my normie friend. And I'll say, man, if I can have one drink, I would love to. You know, the problem is, my truth is, I can't. The physical part of my disease doesn't allow that to happen, man. And once you pass it, there's no going back. That's the truth I found. So at that point, I know God separated me, and I conceded that I was going to need His help, and He would drive me through these steps. And I was a little bit upset with God. And me and Him weren't exactly on speaking terms when I came into this program. But I know that He wanted to have something to do with me, even when I didn't want to have anything to do with Him. And in step two, I found a confession where He would be more like a friend or a father. You know, and on those terms, I was able to turn it over and make sort of an important contract in step three, where I was no longer going to be in charge of the show. As much as I know how to run the world, I'm just going to lay back for a while, so, you know, and incorporate His power to give me guidance and direction. And He has done that. You know, He has truly done that. What a relief, man, that Eric Lee doesn't have to be in charge of everything anymore. You know, what a relief that I can trust His infinite power rather than my finite power. What a relief that I have a book that has taught me a way of living far beyond the alcohol and the other stuff I'm powerless over. What a relief He was to guide me through an inventory that changed my life forever. You know, in my inventory, I felt something very important, which was a realization. I've been in therapy and on medications for a long time. I'm free from every single one of those things, and I'm like, you're done with that. It's not those aren't a solution, they're not my solution anymore. I got something more powerful. And if you think alcohol is powerful, I'm here to tell you that God's much more powerful than that. You will take that obsession that you have, that obsession is with you right now, man. And say, oh man, once I got out of this meeting, I might want to take a drink, or I better hide, I better call 10 people. He will take that and remove it, and you will never obsess over drinking again. It's a guarantee. You know, our co-founders knew what they were talking about when they wrote this book. I was talking to Pat, our main speaker tonight. The book was divinely written. You know, and that's my belief. The proof is that it works. You know, and he was the guy who threw this realization in my fourth step that the therapy thing didn't work, because as far as I ever got was, this is who I'm mad at, this is why, and this is how it affects me. Man, that's pretty easy for us, isn't it? Isn't it easy to point our fingers across the room and tell you how it's everybody else's fault? But when I took a look at the same spot deep down up there, I could see that a lot of the things I was pissed off about, I've been doing the exact same thing to other people. You know, the way I was hurt, I was causing that hurt right now. You know, well, what's my part in being physically abused as a child? I'm not a part of that, right? But you know what I do? I saw this fact that carrying that around for so long and doing damage in that person's name was a pretty big part. You know, and all the drinking and destruction that I did behind that. Things like that. God would listen to me and he sat with me and my sponsor, and I shared this out loud at step 5, you know. 6 and 7, he just went ahead and removed a lot of defective character from me. He did it. You know, I'm not working on those today. It's not a continual project. You know, my sobriety is, it doesn't take a whole lot of energy. The energy and the power and the strength comes from the Almighty, man. And the power that's deep within. He just removed these defective character so that I could go out and do what I'm doing right now. And that's in the amends process, you know. This program is so amazing. I got a lot of damage to repair, you know, and I'm really aware of that today. I didn't really do a lot of damage to the people close to me and my friends and family. I did a lot of damage in the fellowship, you know. I was doing things that were just uncalled for. I was able to go back and make some amends within the fellowship, and I'm still doing that, in particular to my home group and stuff. And today I feel like a new person. I know that I'm unrecognizable compared to the man I once was. There's no question in my mind that God has completely changed me. And then, like I said, I'm not a work in progress, but the miracle has happened, man. Like the guy said, he's sober, right? And that is great, and I'm grateful to be sober. But just being sober is not enough for me, you know. I gotta work this program. I gotta go out and do everything if I wanna get the results. And today I'm really in that process. It's amazing. I'm not making my amends. I'm also working with other guys. So before I close up, I'll just say that if there's anybody that is still sick and suffering, and then it's heard anything I've had to say tonight, that I'm here to help you. I'm not really here for myself. This is a pretty cool stage, though. I was excited when I saw it. You know, I was like, man, I get to be up there and speak, but it's really not about that today at all. It's about carrying the message that's outlined in this book. It's about me helping another alcoholic change this internal condition, our natures, you know, what's happening on the inside, so that the external environment can improve. But it's an inside job and starts from within, and I'm just grateful to do that today. If there's anybody who wants to go through this process, you know, my big book tells me that I'm to make the approach, that I'm not sick anymore. I'm supposed to approach the men and the women who may still be suffering from this disease, and that's what I'm here to do. With that being said, I'm looking forward to hearing Pat, and God bless each and every one of you. I love you, and if there's anything I can do at all, I'm at your back and call. Thank you.
Okay. Now it is my privilege to introduce tonight's main speaker. Please help me offer a warm Tulare County welcome to Pat Wise from Palm Desert, California. You guys could do better than that. Hi, everybody. My name is Pat, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm really glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me. It's an honor and a privilege to participate in the meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I was in this town once before, 50 years ago. God, that makes me sound old, doesn't it? Actually spent one night of my honeymoon to my first husband in this town, sleeping on his aunt's couch. I don't know why we were doing that. That doesn't seem like a very romantic thing to be doing on a honeymoon, but we definitely did that, and I don't know why, but I've not been back until this very moment. So, this, I think, is a better visit. I love being sober. I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love the way I love the way that I get to live my life today. If you're new, I want to welcome you. I'm here at Alcoholics Anonymous, and I hope that you find here what I and obviously many other people here have found. I started drinking when I was 13 because I was at a party and people were drinking, and I just, kind of wanted to fit in, and they were drinking rum and coke, so I drank rum and coke, and the magic happened to me that I assume happened to you if you're sitting in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that is, it changed how I felt. It changed how I felt about me, and it changed how I felt about you. I have always described myself as being extremely shy. In Alcoholics Anonymous, you call things by different names. You call that one self-obsession. I like shy better. Shy implies it's not my fault, I can't help it. But self-obsessed is what I am. I think about me all the time. How do I look? How do I sound? What are you thinking about me? And so I'm at this party and I'm feeling all of that, and somebody handed me that rum and coke and I drank it, and those feelings went away. I think I probably relaxed for the first time in my life that night. I drank too much that night, which was to be my habit, and I blacked out and passed out, and I woke up in bed the next morning with a Marine that I didn't know. Now, that was a lot more than I meant to do that night. I was a nice girl from Newport Beach. The girls in my tribe were not behaving this way, and I felt bad the next day. I was embarrassed. I was ashamed. I was terrified I'd get pregnant, but I drank again at the very next opportunity without a second thought. I was apparently willing to pay the price to drink from the gate, I mean, I didn't think any of this through at the time. If it sounds like I have insight into my life, believe me, I didn't have it at the time. The insight came long after I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. But really, I started having insight into my life when I started sponsoring other women in Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, I, for a while, I was a periodic, mostly because of my age. I didn't have access to alcohol every day, but I found it, and often, we're like magnets, we find each other, I'm 13, 14, 15 years old, and I don't ever remember asking anybody, where do you get a phony ID, but I became possessed of one. I don't remember asking anybody, where are the bars or the liquor stores in Newport that will sell to minors, but somehow I became possessed of that knowledge, and I drank at every opportunity. When I drank, my behavior never got any better than that first night. When I drink, as I like to describe it, I get friendly. And so I developed this reputation in high school for being a friendly girl. And, that's not how I wanted people to think of me. I meant to grow up and get married and stay married to the same person forever and, have some kids and live a decent life. And I'm 13, 14, 15 years old, and I kind of know already. I was going to take my watch off, but I can't figure out how to get it off. So we may just be here all. Oh, there's a clock back there. Okay, good. It'll be here all night. I'm drinking mostly on weekends at parties and behaving badly and developing this reputation and feeling bad about myself and getting in a lot of trouble. My parents were obviously concerned, and they sent me away to boarding school for my last couple years of high school, and it did what they wanted it to do, in the sense that it was a very structured all-girls school, and it was very hard to, first of all, there were no boys there, and secondly, it was very hard to drink there, it was very hard to get alcohol there, and so I think alcoholics, when they're applying themselves, work harder than anybody. The problem, obviously, is we don't apply ourselves all that often, but when I was in that boarding school and I didn't have all those distractions or the ability to drink, I studied hard and I brought my grades back up and I graduated successfully, and I got married when I was 18 to the man that I spent that night in this town. He was a really nice person. I had no business getting married. I had no more business getting married than trying to fly to the moon. I was so selfish and self-centered. I was, in retrospect, you know, an alcoholic, very, very badly in need of a drink. You know, we got married and we're a young married couple. We don't have much money. You know, we got these little jobs, and so we don't have much money to drink. We drank a little bit when we were dating, and but now we're married. We don't have money to drink, and I can see today clearly. I was restless, irritable, discontent, as our book describes. I needed a drink. I didn't know that. I just knew that I didn't feel happy there, and it wasn't that we were fighting or anything. I mean, he was a perfectly nice fellow. I don't even remember having an argument with him, but. We were actually only married for 6 months because I needed to leave. You know, I made other things the excuse, but really, I just needed to drink. I divorced him, and he didn't really know what had happened. You know, he didn't know why I'd left, and I wouldn't talk to him about it because I didn't know why I'd left. You know, I just knew that I had to. I mention that, I almost always mention it when I talk, because when I got sober in alcohol, that all happened when I was 18. I got sober when I was almost 31, and I didn't see him then in all that time. And I saw him after I was sober a few months, and he didn't see me, I saw him. And I thought, wow, this is pretty cool. Here I am, sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, and God drops this guy in my path. Here's an opportunity to make amends. You know, this is pretty cool. And then my next thought was, I'm not sober all that long, and I'm not actually that sick yet. And I let that opportunity pass by. That was 38 years ago, and I haven't seen it from that day to this. You know, it's an amend that I should have made. It's my strong recommendation. An opportunity to make amends present themselves if you do it, of course, with your sponsor's direction. You know, I hope I get another stab at this one. I really wish I'd done it. I actually know where he lives today. You know, with the internet, you can find anybody today. And I know exactly where he is. But I talked to my sponsor about it, and she said, you know, Pat, I don't think that he's married, and may or may not have grown children, I don't know, but he's definitely married. And she said, I don't think that you have the right to leap into somebody's life 50 years after the fact to make amends. Because you might be creating grounds for new amends. You know, you don't have the right to disrupt his life in a way that might be uncomfortable for him. And so I think you have to sit on that and hope that God does give you a shot at it, but you can't go pursue it. And that's hard. It's hard. I pray about it every day that God, if it is his will, that I get another chance to try to make amends to him. Anyway, so now I'm 18 and a half. I'm divorced. And I moved to L.A., which is about 50 miles up the street from where I've been living. And I got a job in an apartment, and I'm working as a secretary in a trucking company, and I'm drinking with these truck drivers, and I'm behaving there exactly the way I behaved in high school, which is to say, before I left that trucking company, I knew most of those truck drivers. And my parents were divorced when I was really young. My father was vice president of that company, which is how I got the job. I remember I called him one day. You know, when you're young and you don't have your first job, it's hard to get that first job. And so I had this really good secretarial skill. So I called my dad and I said, would you consider hiring me? It's hard to get, you know, I need a job. And he was very reluctant to do. I remember he said, oh, I don't know. I don't think it's a good idea to hire a family member. He should have listened to his instincts. He hired me, and I ended up there. I behaved badly there. He called me one day. I'd been there about 6 or 7 months, and he called me, and he tried to talk to me about the way I was behaving, because everybody was talking about me. And I don't know about you. Well, you know about you. But we can't talk about this. I can't even think about it myself. I certainly can't talk to my father about it. And so I said some really ugly things to him on the phone that day just to get him off the phone. The end result of that conversation is he and I did not talk again until, except when absolutely necessary at weddings and funerals, until I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous and made amends to him, and we have a good relationship today.
So, you know, I owe that 100% to Alcoholics Anonymous. Anyway, I left that job and I went on to the next job. And, you know, that job pretty much described every job I had. I'm a very good secretary. I never had any trouble getting a job. And when I was new on the job, I'd be kind of nervous. I wanted, you know, make a good impression and do a good job and all of that. So I would keep my drinking separate for a while, but eventually I would relax on that job, and then the drinking would creep in, you know, and then I'd be drinking a little at lunchtime, or drinking a lot at lunchtime, and I'd be drinking after work with my boss and the clients and the coworkers, and sleeping with them, or their spouses. Doesn't matter to me, and I create a big ugly mess, you know, and I have to leave, and that's what I did, job to job to job. When I got sober, there was the 20 questions. There was a question on there, have you ever lost a job because of drinking? And I checked no. And I hadn't. I had never been fired from a job because of drinking. But when I got a little more honest, I quit every job I had. Every job I had because of drinking. Because of I had so humiliated myself, or, you know, the heat was so I remember I quit more than one job after an office Christmas party without going back to hang out my desk, because I knew that I couldn't face those people in the light of day after what I had done the night before. I drank a lot in blackouts, and frankly, I'm grateful for them. I remember plenty. I do not need more information, but, you know, here's how I drank. I went out with my boss and my coworkers one night. We're bar hopping around downtown L.A., and we were all drunk. But I guess I was drunker than they, and when we wound up in the strip joint, I was the only one who auditioned for a job. Not really my fault. I know you'll understand when I explain this to you. We were at the stages, like here, we were at this table directly in front, and I'd excuse myself from the table to go to the ladies' room, which was kind of down the hall behind the stage, and bumped into the owner of the bar in the hallway there, and was making some derogatory remarks about the caliber of his entertainment, and he said something to me along the lines of, if you think you're such hot stuff, which apparently I thought. So, a moment ago I was sitting here with my boss and my coworkers dressed sort of like I'm dressed tonight, and then moments later I'm on the stage essentially dressed in nothing, and there was that moment when my boss's eye and mine met, and he realized who that was up there. I can still see the look on his face, honestly, like it just happened. It's forever etched in my, probably his mind too. It was definitely a moment. That was another job I quit without, going back to clean up my desk. So you kind of get the idea. You know, I had no direction, no purpose, no nothing in my life. I remember one time I discovered this bar in San Juan Capistrano. Now, San Juan Capistrano is not around the corner from where I was living in L.A. It's probably, I don't know, 100 miles maybe, 7,500 miles away. And somehow I discovered this bar that had this mariachi band. The mariachi band played there every Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night. There were 8 or 10 guys in this band, and they played there, and then those nights they stayed in a little local motel near the bar, and then on Sunday nights after they finished, they drove back to Tijuana, presumably to their wives and many children. I don't know, because none of them spoke English, but I became sort of their, not sort of, I became their groupie. And I drove from Los Angeles to San Juan Capistrano every Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night. I would hand the bartender my purse. First thing I did when I hand the bartender my purse, everybody knew me. Hand the bartender my purse, he'd put it behind the bar so I wouldn't lose it. And I would sit at the bar and I would drink and request those sad songs, you know. And then at some point there's a little dance floor where the patrons of the bar could dance. And at some point during the evening, one of these mariachi players would put his instrument down and ask me to dance. And I can remember moving around the dance floor with this guy thinking that all of you, the other people there at the bar, must be looking at me with, I don't know, awe and admiration, thinking I must be somebody because I seem to know the band. Okay, I knew the band. I knew the whole band. I went there every Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night for, I don't know how long, the better part of the year, I think. And then I didn't go anymore, and I don't know why. To this day, I don't know why. I can only assume that something by my now diminishing standards happened that was so bad that even I couldn't go back there. I don't know. Mercifully, I don't remember what it was. You know, I was sober, I don't know, 10 or 15 years, and I got asked to speak in a meeting not far from there. And I got to go down there that night, and I got there really early. I had some time to chill, and I thought, I wonder if that place is still there. And I drove around, I found it, and it was dark, and there was, you could sort of see there's a little light, you know, from the crack of the door there. And I parked across the street. I just sat in my car a few minutes thinking about it and looking at that door and thinking about all that time that I spent in there. And I couldn't remember one happy night there. I couldn't remember one really fun time, one really great dance, one really good laugh. Every memory I could come up with from that place was kind of humiliating and sad and just awful. And yet I drove there every Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday night for a long time. You know, that's what alcoholism does to me. You know, I have no choice. But you were talking about choice in the meeting today. I have no choice in my life. None. No choices about anything. I got married again. So this strip joint, you know, when I woke up the next morning after that incident, I was properly horrified at what I'd done, but it gave me ideas, and I actually got a job as a go-go dancer. Go-go dancing, in my mind's eye, seemed much classier than stripping. It's not, but I convinced myself that it was. And there were actually nightclubs, like on Sunset Strip, that had go-go dancers. I did not work in those nightclubs. I worked in terrible places. And I met the man who was become my second husband in one of these places where I was working. And he was, let's just say probably the most unsuitable man in the state of California for me. So, of course, we moved right in together and eventually got married. And, you know, now I'm married again, but I am a full-blown alcoholic by this point. And my life is completely out of control. We had a lot of trouble. He drank, and then I met him in a bar, but he didn't drink as much as I did, and my drinking and my behavior behind drinking got to be this big topic of conversation around our house. Because although I'm married now, I'm still behaving like I'm single, you know. I am completely out of control, and so we had a lot of trouble. I cheated on him all the time, and it was bad. He was a big gambler, and he was gone a lot at night at the racetrack, and, you know, actually that was fine with me. I was drinking more and more at home. I started getting arrested, and I couldn't believe this was happening to me. I'm a nice girl from Newport Beach. I can't believe I'm in jail, but I was in jail, you know, not for any big, exciting bank robbery or anything. My first arrest was on a Thanksgiving night. I'd been to dinner at my parents' house in Newport. And did I mention my parents were unhappy about this marriage? He wasn't invited to Thanksgiving dinner. Actually, they never met him. They felt so strongly about it. So I've gone to my parents' house for Thanksgiving dinner. My husband went to, he was a chef, and his boss at the restaurant had a party buffet for employees and their family, so he's gone to that in L.A. I drank, my parents were big drinkers. I drank a lot at their house. I was driving home, I was drunk, and I stopped in a bar on Main Street in downtown L.A., which is Skid Row, which was not in the direct line from my parents' home to where I was living, but nonetheless, that's where I stopped, and, you know, I drank some more there, and came out and got arrested for common drunk on Main Street. They took me to Civil Brand, which was the women's institution there, and used to be in Los Angeles, and I remember that I could make a phone call, and I remember where my husband was, so I called him at his boss's house. The boss's wife answered the phone. I identified myself and I told her that I was in jail, so she had my husband come bail me out. It did not occur to me that it might have been nicer to maybe ask to speak directly to him to deliver that happy news. And yet, you know, years later when I finally made it to Alcoholics Anonymous, I remember sitting in meetings a long time hearing you talk about making amends and thinking, no, I don't really think I've hurt anybody. You know, if I knew you, I'd probably hurt you, because I am, as a big would describe, completely selfish and self-centered. But it took a long time to see that. So it was Dad. You get the idea of Dad. But he's a good gambler. He's gone a lot at night, and you know, that's fine with me. I'm just sitting in a rocking chair in my living room in a purple flannel bathrobe and drinking every night until I pass out. And I'm good with that, you know. I'm good with it. I played those Dad records over and over again. My personal favorite. To this day, when I hear it on the radio or something, it's just kind of like a knife in my heart. Ray Charles, Born to Lose. Oh, man. I play it and cry and feel sorry for myself. And sometimes I call people on the phone. I've heard AA speakers say that they, you know, called the White House and demanded to speak to the president. I would never do that. I call people I knew. Most memorably, a boyfriend I had when I was 12. I wonder what Danny's doing these days. Of course, I have no idea where Danny might be living, so I wake up, and you know, if you're a phone caller or if you're an Al-Anon, you've got some of these calls, that it never happens at 7:30 in the evening. You know, it's always 2 in the morning or something. And so I wake up several other people, and I found Danny and his wife, and I'm pretty sure they were happy to hear from me. Maybe not. I hated my husband. I wasn't getting along with my parents. I hated my job. I had this little job now. You know, I peaked in my career when I was about 23. When I was 23 years old, I was working as a legal secretary. I was making really, really good money for somebody that age. And, you know, really a good future ahead of me. And my last job before I got sober when I was 30 was as a clerk in a YMCA. And I was barely hanging on to that job, barely hanging on to it. So my life was not good, not good. I called Alcoholics Anonymous one night. I was drunk when I called. I have no idea what triggered the notion that particular night to call, but I called. And a real nice man at central office answered the phone and asked if I was having a problem with alcohol. I said that I was, and I started to cry. And I was embarrassed about that, but I was drunk enough just to stay on the phone anyway. And he talked to me a long time, told me a lot about himself. And I remember he wanted to send some women to my house. I said, oh, no, thank you. I don't think I'm that bad. And he seemed to understand. And he said, do you think you could not drink tomorrow and go to a meeting tomorrow night? And I said, yes. Now, actually, I doubt very much that I'm not going to drink tomorrow. I mean, I drink every day. But yes was obviously the right answer. So I said, yes. The next day, the next morning, I came to, and I remembered making the phone call, and I remembered, you know, parts of the conversation, and I had written the address down of the meeting place, and, you know, the next morning in the light of day, I thought I'd been a little premature about calling AA, but I couldn't get it out of my mind all day, and I heard myself say to my husband that night at the dinner table, I'm going to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. He said something really loving to me, like, yeah, whatever. You know, we were not getting along at all. And I went to my first meeting. I had no idea what was about to happen. No idea at all. It was a big meeting in the basement of the church in Santa Monica. There were probably 350 people there, maybe. And it might as well have been 30,000 people. You know, I saw them all like we were here tonight, you know, kissing and hugging and going down these basement steps. And obviously, they've all known each other their entire lives, and I'm the only one who's an outsider here. There's no way I can get out of this car and go in that room. There is no way I can do it, but somehow I did. And I walked down the stairs, and there was a man standing at the door who put out his hand and said, hello, my name is Clint. Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that's the most important thing anybody ever does in a meeting. It made me feel welcome. He later became a dear friend, but that night just made me feel welcome. I went in, and it was an 8:30 meeting, so of course I got there at 8:28. I was sober. I didn't drink that day, but I needed a drink bad. Sometimes by 8:30 I'm already passed out, you know, so I'm not feeling very well that night. So he takes me, now I'm in the room, it's 8:29. People are milling around. I'm looking for a seat, and a man comes out of the crowd and asks me if I'm new. And I can't imagine how he knows that. You know, it could have been the terrible clothes I was wearing, or perhaps the sweat, which was, you know, pouring out. Who knows? But he seemed to know. And I said that I was, and it seemed like that. There's about 50 women coming at me, and they're all writing their numbers on little slips of paper, and they got me a big book, whatever in the world a big book might be, and they got me a seat, and the meeting began. It was a speaker meeting, and the speaker that night was a man by the name of Norm A., and I heard him. we actually drank in one of the same places. He's not at the same, he was a much older man than I, but I identified. I believed that he drank the way I drank. I believed that he was sober. I could see that he was sober. And I was sitting way in the back of this big room, and I could feel his energy and his enthusiasm for life. I could feel it way in the back of the room. I think that night, maybe if you'd asked me, I would have said, I don't know, maybe I can stay sober if I do whatever that guy's doing, but I will never be able to feel the way he's feeling. You can't get from here to there. It's impossible. But what I got that night, of course, was hope. We got up at the end of the meeting, we held hands and said the Lord's Prayer. And at the end of the Lord's Prayer, when they said, keep coming back, these two nice people on either side of me squeezed my hand. I did not know the whole room was doing that. I thought it was just these two people, and I was very touched, I have to tell you. But the minute they dropped my hand, I was out the door. I'm like stark raving sober. There is no way I can stay here and chat with you. I'm completely incapable of that. But I had the big book, and I sat up most of that night reading it, and I remember thinking, this is great. I liked the meeting. I really did. I wanted to go to that meeting every Saturday night and be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I heard you say that night that I should go to a lot of meetings, and I thought every Saturday sounded like a lot. So, surprise, surprise, I drank again on Friday. Now, on the one hand, Saturday to Friday, I didn't drink. And I remember every day thinking, wow, AA really works. This is great. And then on Friday I'm drunk, and I kind of can't believe it. And I go back to the meeting Saturday, and I raise my hand for being under a week of sobriety again, and I got some more phone numbers. I had plenty the week before, and one of these women said, you know, it really works better if you call one of these numbers. And I couldn't imagine calling you. I don't know you. What would I say to you? I drank a couple more times that week, and then I called that woman who said that to me, and I was drunk when I called her. And she said, you don't seem to be doing too well on your own. I think you need a sponsor. Most of us have found that to be pretty helpful. I said, all right, what's a sponsor? And boy, she got all excited, and so I'll be it. And how do I get one? What is it? What is it? I'll be your sponsor. And okay, what do I do? And she said, meet me tomorrow. And if you have a big book, I said, yes. And she said, bring it with you. So meet me tomorrow night and meet me early, and we'll sit and talk about sponsorship and Alcoholics Anonymous. And the next night was a Thursday. That's not meeting night, you know. But I somehow sensed that maybe I shouldn't point that out to her, you know. So I said, okay. And I met her the next night, and the first thing she did is she took a copy of the meeting directory. She circled the meeting for every night of the week for me to go to. She didn't suggest or recommend. She said, on Monday we'll go here, on Tuesday there, we all go here on Wednesday. And I said, oh, excuse me, I can't possibly do that. I'm a married woman. My husband is not happy at all that I'm at this meeting tonight. I certainly cannot go every night. It's completely out of hand. This huge fight before I left the house tonight about me coming tonight. I can't do it. I can't. And she said something like, well, maybe you can do it with less than that with me as your sponsor. She said something like, if you want me to be your sponsor, I assume it's because you want what I have. And if you want what I have, I only know one way to get it, and that's to do what I do. And this is what I do. I didn't know it then, but it's so clear to me now, my lifetime in the balance right there in that conversation. You know, it could have gone either way. And I found myself agreeing to do what she was asking me to do. Now, if you're new, this is important. I didn't agree happily, and I didn't do it happily, but I did it. And that's why I'm standing here 38 years later. You know, I just did it. And your attitude, thank God, attitude is being handled. Attitude matters. You have a different standard if you had a much smaller meeting, you know. I just started doing what she told me to do, and I whined about everything. I cried all the time. I fought with my husband every night before I went to meet. He fought. I was coming to Alcoholics Anonymous to meet men. Now, it's true I cheated on him all the years we've been married. It's also true that I noticed there were men in Alcoholics Anonymous. It's also true that I was more than willing to get better acquainted with some of you gentlemen. But none of the men in AA appeared to be interested in me, which hurt my feelings. And it really made me mad that my husband was accusing me of something I was not actually doing right at that minute. And so I felt really, really, really sorry for myself. Every night we would have dinner and we'd have this huge fight about me going to the meeting. And I would get in the car sobbing hysterically. It's a miracle I wasn't killed in the car accident driving to the meeting, because I cried all the way to every meeting for probably the first year. My father told me I had to get to every meeting 1 hour early, not 55 minutes early, 1 hour early. And I had to have commitments, early commitments, like cookies or chairs or coffee, you know, things you do before the meeting. And I was to get to the meeting and 1 hour early and do my commitment and then circulate throughout the room and shake hands with other people as they got there, introduce myself, ask them how they are, as though I care. Get some phone numbers of three women that I don't already have, and then tomorrow, after the meeting, in addition to calling my sponsor, I'm going to call these three women whose numbers I got the night before. So I've had this huge fight with my husband. I'd be in the car driving to the meeting, sobbing hysterically, thinking to myself, you know what, it's not worth it. If this is sobriety, you can have it. I'll go to this stupid meeting tonight because I'm already out of the house tonight, but this is the last one. I can't do this. It's too hard. I can't do it. And I'd get to the meeting and I'd sign the cookies around the kitchen or whatever my job was, and then I'd come out and work the room, you know. Hi, Fred, how are you? And Fred would say something like, fine, Pat, how are you? And I'd tell him how I was, you know, and until his eyes would glaze over. And I'd move on to the, hi, Mary, how are you? And eventually, mercifully, the meeting would start, and I'd get some relief for myself. One night, I learned the most important, about 3 or 4 months sober, I learned the single most important thing I think I've learned in 38 years. I was working the room, as I just described to you, and I went up to this, I used to say an old timer, and he's got like 6 more months of me or something. I went up to him and he asked me how I was, and I started to tell him, and he cut me off in mid-sentence. He said, I don't want to listen to that. Why don't you go find a newcomer to talk to? Perhaps she'd feel better. And he pointed to a girl in the back of the room, and he said, that girl over there is at her very first meeting. Why don't you just march over and say hello? I remember thinking that I didn't care if that girl lived or died. I wish Larry would die and mind his own business. But I knew if I didn't go talk to that girl that he would tell my sponsor. So it just shouldn't take but a moment. I'll just go for and say hello. If my memory serves me correctly, I believe I was crying as I welcomed her to Alcoholics Anonymous. I put my hand out, I introduced myself, and the girl who had 12-stepped her, who I knew, said, oh, Pat, I'm so happy to see you. This is this girl's first meeting, and she had this big fight with her husband about coming to AA, and I knew you were the exact right person to talk to her. Yeah, no, I don't think so. I think I'm the, this is like first second thinking. You know, I'm standing in front of this girl and I'm thinking, I am the worst person in this room to talk to her. I fight with my husband all the time about, I have nothing of value to share here. I kind of overlooked that I was sober 3 or 4 months. That's kind of valuable. But all I could see was how sad and tragic my life was, you know? But I'm standing in front of them thinking that, and at the same time I'm thinking, I'm standing in front of somebody at their very first meeting. I really need to say something positive here. I opened up my mouth, and I heard myself say, keep coming back, it gets better a day at a time. Now I've just lied to a newcomer. I don't think it's getting better at all. Again, I'm overlooking that I am sober. Kind of important. But here's what happened to me. I know I didn't talk to this girl. I was incapable of having a conversation with her. I 20 seconds, who knows. There was a center aisle in the room. I was walking back down that center aisle, and I had this moment where I realized that it was the first time in that 3 or 4 months, however long I was sober, in that hour period of time, from the time I hit the door of the meeting hall until the meeting actually starts, that I was there and I wasn't crying. And the reason I wasn't crying is for that brief little moment I tried to think of something positive to say to this girl who was newer than me, and I felt better. It turns out, when I'm thinking about you, I can't be thinking about me at the same time. And any time I'm not thinking about me, I'm having a better day. And so is everybody around me, you know. I would like to tell you from that moment this, I've happily worked with others in life and ran, but that would be a lie. But it works. There's a line in the book. I hate when I start a sentence that way because I can never quote anything precisely, but to the effect that when all else fails, working with another alcoholic will save the day. It's the truth. It was the truth that day. It's the truth this day. It always works. You know, it seemed clear to me that the problems in my marriage had to be his fault. I mean, I'm working this spiritual program now. It can't be my fault. fault. I'm not exactly working a spiritual program at home. I'm like a crazy person, but I couldn't see my card in anything. And with an attitude like that, of course, it was inevitable that I would meet a man in a meeting who looked good to me. Actually, I've met many, but one who looked bad. I was about 10 months sober. The gentleman in question was about 10 minutes sober. I saw him when he came to the door the first time. He had a shaved head and a Fu Manchu mustache, and the heart started to pound. I just thought he was just, oh my gosh, I leapt across the chair or two to introduce myself to him, and my sponsor noticed. And went over to her, and she said, let's not forget, Patty, you're a married woman. And I said, yeah, but I am so unhappy. And she said, nonetheless, you're married. And as long as you're married, I expect you to act married. So I did not see this as a problem. I'll get divorced. And she said, no. We in Alcoholics Anonymous don't think it's a good idea to make major moves in our first year of sobriety. I want you to just stay married and act married. Well, I was obsessed with this man. I just couldn't understand why my sponsor couldn't see. Why would God get this guy sober in my home group if he didn't mean for us to be together? I see that you understand. So we began, I now refer to this as the death dance. It starts with the meaningful glances across the room, and then we're kind of brushing up against each other in the coffee line, and then he's walking me to my car after the meeting, and then I'm parking further and further away from the meeting, and the team gets a little bit complicated to actually get together. I mean, I'm a married woman, obviously we're not going to go to my place. He's a newcomer, he does not have a place. People can make anything happen. I mean, we're really very resourceful. We also at the time working at a record company in Hollywood, and he was very conveniently also working in Hollywood at a porn book store. So I arranged this lunch hour one day, long lunch hour one day at work for somebody to cover for me, and he didn't have a car either, so I picked him up at the bookstore, and we went to a motel and got to know each other better, and I dropped him off at the bookstore that afternoon. I was driving back to my office, and it occurred to me in the car that day that I was 10 months sober, and I was living exactly the way I'd always lived. I'd been sitting in meetings for 10 months, and they say pretty much every night that I can change everything about the way I've been living my life. I was probably going to drink, and I knew that day that I was in a lot of trouble. I will tell you, I'm 38 years that day, as the closest I've been to picking up a drink. I was scared to tell my sponsor what I'd done because she'd been so clear in her direction about this guy. But the bottom line is I don't want to drink, you know. And so I told my sponsor what I'd done. And she said, you know, Pat, I don't think you're a woman who can cheat on her husband and stay sober. And you don't have to live that way anymore if you don't want to. Okay, I don't want to. You know what? I've never wanted to live that way, drunk or sober. I never wanted to live that way. Not wanting to do it doesn't make anything happen. You know, not wanting is not wanting. It's useless. Here's what I did. If this interests you at all, you've got to pay really close attention because this goes by real fast. Here's what I did. A day at a time, I stayed away from that guy. That's it. That's it. A day at a time, I didn't drive by that bookstore. A day at a time, I didn't call him. A day at a time, I didn't take his calls. A day at a time, when I saw him in the meeting, I shook hands with a locked elbow. If you're new, that means you never got closer than the entire length of my arm. Hello. And I kept moving. I thought I should explain to him what was going on here. I unfortunately ran that idea by my sponsor, and she said, oh, I think you'll get the idea. And so I did it her way. I heard for the first time that line that is read in every single meeting I go to, half measures avail of nothing. I heard it, and I knew for me this is going to be the big make it or break it moment. You know, I knew for me I was going to have to figure out a way to change this way of living, or I was going to drink for sure. And so I did it 100% of her way. Now here's the thing. The obsession, of course, passed. Obsessions always pass. But the really good news, and the part I've never even dreamed of, is I don't live that way anymore. I simply don't live that way anymore. What a gift. You know, what an incredible gift. My first sponsor drank when I was a year and a half sober. I got a new sponsor right away who was sober a long time. And the first thing she said to me is, I watched you whine about your husband from across the room, and I don't want to hear it. I want you a day at a time to act as though you're a kind and loving wife. You owe a lot of amends to that man. The big book is really clear on some of these amends, difficult amends. It says right in the steps you can't make direct amends. What to do if I might injure that person or others. She said, that means that you cannot go home and confess infidelities you may not know about. You can't. It's not about clearing your conscience. It's about making things right. She said, I don't know what's going to happen to your marriage. Maybe it'll end. I mean, it doesn't seem like a very good marriage, but maybe if you stay there a day at a time and act as though you're a kind and loving wife, you'll be able to make some daily living amends to him and make up for some of that stuff that you've done over the years that you've been married to him. And then if you do have to walk away somewhere down the road, maybe you can do it with no guilt. No guilt got my attention because I had a lot of guilt. And so I started doing what she was telling me to do. She gave me some very specific directions, and then I also started watching people in AA, other couples, how they treated each other. There's in AA, there's good examples and there's bad examples. And I tried to take the good stuff and go home and practice it in my home. And, you know, some days were good, some days were great, other days were not so good. But I just did it a day at a time. And one night I don't know how long I've been doing it, a few months maybe, close to a year, I really don't know. Maybe 6 months. I don't know, it doesn't matter. I was on my knees saying my prayers, which were very, pretty brief in those days. In the morning, dear God, please help me stay sober today, amen. And at night, thank you for keeping me sober today. And I was on my knees saying that prayer, thank you for keeping me sober today, amen. And I started to get up off my knees and I realized that I'm comfortable in that house with that husband. And it hadn't happened that day. It had already happened before. I don't know when it happened. I got back down on my knees that night and I thanked God for this new feeling. I wasn't even sure what it was, but I said, God, I believe that you mean for me to stay married to this man, that I could do that and stay sober and have a happy life. Thank you. Not long after that, we found out that he had cancer. My first thought was that this is who I am. I'm selfish and self-centered as well. This is what happened when I hated him. I'm very glad it did not happen when I hated him. I just kept doing what I had been doing, you know. He was sick for a year and a half and he did die. And it was hard. I used to say it was the hardest year and a half of my life. That is no longer true. But it was at that point. But it was also the best year and a half of our marriage. I was so glad that I had stayed there when all of my best judgment had suggested that I should leave. I was so glad that I was there that last year and a half when he was so sick. And he knew that I was there because I wanted to be there, not just because he was sick and, you know, I felt some obligation to take care of him. And I mean, it was there and unbelievable. You know what I'm saying? When he died, I made these funeral arrangements at this little chapel, and a couple hundred people from Alcoholics Anonymous took the afternoon out to be there. They didn't know him, but they knew me, and they came, of course, to support me. And I realized sitting in that chapel that day that what my sponsor had promised had happened. I knew that I had 100% made my amends to him. I felt sad, obviously, about his death, but I felt 100% right about my relationship with him and knowing that I had 100% made my amends to him. I was so, so grateful that I had stayed in that marriage. I remember thinking, wow, that's like the big payoff for doing the work. You know, I stayed there a day at a time and I did what she suggested and now I get this great feeling, you know, of knowing that that's an amend that is 100% made. That's fantastic. Thank you, God. Here's the thing. My God has a much bigger vision for me than I have. That was not even close to the big payoff. I hate that phrase, but I don't know how else to describe it. After he died, I started dating a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. We fell in love. We got married. We were married for 27 years. We had the best life together, just the best life together. We're both very active members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Our house was always filled with crazy newcomers, and you know, the phone was always ringing off the hook, and just such a great life together. He died quite suddenly a few years ago, and I'm telling you, my heart broke. I couldn't believe a person could hurt that bad and still, like, walk around. You know, it gave a whole new meaning to the term broken heart to me, really. It did. the day that he died of a heart attack. I had talked to him on the phone in the morning. I was at work, and the last words we said to each other before we hung up were, "I love you." That's not a mistake. We always said that. I highly recommend it. You can imagine how glad I am that those were the last words we said to each other. And I knew during the day something was wrong, because he usually called me a couple of times and he didn't, and he wasn't available. You know, he wasn't answering his phone. I came home and I found him. He was dead. I made one phone call to somebody who wasn't home, a friend on the program who wasn't home, and I left a message and turned around, and my house was filled with sober alcoholics, and they walked me through everything. Just absolutely walked me through everything. I did not have to do anything. In case I forget to say it, I have to say that I felt as bad as a person could feel for 2 years. I just couldn't believe I could feel that bad. But not once, did the idea of picking up a drink cross my mind. And that's because I've been in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous all these years, and I continue to be in the middle of Alcoholics Anonymous, even feeling that bad. I never felt like going to a meeting for quite a while. I didn't feel like going to meetings, but I went. You know, I didn't feel like going to work, but I went. I didn't feel like taking calls from the women I sponsored, but I took them. You know, I did everything that I was supposed to do. After a couple months after he died, I realized one day that I wasn't praying, that I stopped praying. And I thought, oh, that can't be good. I got to start doing that again. And I couldn't do it. I just couldn't pray. I talked about it because I know what to do. I talked about it in a women's meeting, and a woman there said to me, "Do you think that you could commit to us that you would read the 24-hour-a-day book every day?" And I said, "Well, yeah, I could do that." And she said, "Well, I would recommend you do that." So I started doing that, and eventually it led me back to be able to pray. I realized, I think I know, the kids and I used to pray together at night, and I think that's why I stopped. You know, it was just too hard at first. But I just followed him. I asked for help. I followed directions. It doesn't matter how long sober you are. You know, I have a sponsor today, and I ask for direction. I don't assume that because I'm sober a long time, I can just do this stuff, and you know, that I intuitively know everything. I intuitively know something, but I don't know everything, and I'm not afraid to ask for help. I'm afraid actually not to ask for help. You know, let's see. After he died, my mother, we had moved my mother next door to us a couple of years before he died, because she's getting older, so we could take care of her, but not actually be living together. And right after he died, she became very ill, and I had to start driving her to Pomona 5 days a week for treatment, which was like an hour's drive away. My mother, let's see, how can I say this? Vince and I were one political persuasion, and my mother was the complete opposite. Vince was very, he loved discussing politics. He loved a good political discussion with somebody on the other side who was smart, you know, and could talk intelligently about politics. He loved that kind of interchange. My mother was not a stupid woman, but she was a very good mother-in-law, and she never, ever discussed politics with him. But now he's gone, and we're in the car 5 days a week for an hour driving to Pomona, and she started talking politics. And I thought, she thinks now that he's gone, she can change my mind. I got it right away. I just, now, my first reaction is, what the heck? You know, it's like, come on, Mom, are you crazy? I got it. I can't live long enough to make proper amends to my mother. I've been, let's see, this is 5 years ago, so I was sober, whatever, I'm not good at math. 30 plus years, I've been making daily living amends to my mother. I guess, because it's not over yet. This is not over yet. My whole job here is to make my mother happy. Period. That's it. That's my whole job with my mother. I don't get to disagree with her on anything. So, we're in the car. And she's talking. And I'm saying things like, "Gosh, Mom, I never thought of it that way before." Or, I got this from Al-Anon. You could be right. The veins are sticking out on my neck. I'm not kidding you. I'm just like, I can't believe this is so hard. We get out to Pomona. I get her settled in the treatment thing. And I said, I'm just going to step out in the courtyard and call my office and see if there's anything I need to be, you know, doing. And I'd go out in the courtyard and I'd call a friend on the program and I'd just burst into tears. You know, just from the strain of it. And I'd talk to whoever, you know, that I had reached. And it wasn't like they had some magic answers, just getting it out, you know. And we'd have a little laugh or something. And then I could go back in and be with my mother and everything would be okay, you know. And I'm very proud to say that I think my mother thought she had changed my mind before she died. A couple of days before she died, she said to me, you know, I'm not afraid to die. I've had a long, long, very happy life. And, you know, I'm tired and I'm ready to go, but I'm worried about you, me. She said, you're going to be all alone. Vince is gone and you're going to be all alone. And I said, Mom, you were at Vince's funeral. There were 1,000 people there. I'm not alone. And I could just see that sort of realization come over her face that, yeah, I was going to be okay, you know, and of course I had been. I retired from my job a couple of years ago and I moved to the desert and I love it. I love retirement. I love it. I can't recommend it highly enough. It's the greatest. My life is different than I thought it was going to be, you know. Kids and I had dreams of things and plans and things that we were going to do that now are not going to happen, but I'm creating for, I guess you could say, my new single life, you know, and sometimes it's hard and sometimes it's easy, but I'm not, we were talking earlier, I'm not unhappy. I'm very happy. I have a very happy life. There are moments when I still miss him so much I can hardly stand it. There are moments when something happens and I think, oh my God, I cannot wait until then, and then there's that moment, oh wait, I can't. You know. Although actually I do. Yeah, I kind of think he's listening, but whatever. But by and large, I'm creating this sort of new adventuresome life for myself. I just have to talk about this because it's so exciting to me. A friend and I am like the least athletic person you probably have ever met. But I have started, I can't even believe I'm going to say this word, training. A friend and I are going to go to Spain next year and walk the Camino de Santiago, which, if you're not familiar, is a 500-mile kind of a pilgrimage, and I'm very, very excited about it. It's going to be like the grand adventure of my life, really, you know. And I think about it every day. I'm so excited. We're planning, we're training, we're talking about it all the time. And I love having that. I guess what I'm saying is I've got that spark back, you know, that enthusiasm for something really exciting to look forward to, and that makes me happy. If you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to welcome you here. I hope that you stay. I would recommend you do three things if you're new. One is get a sponsor before you leave this room. Two is get a home group, a place where you are the person who throws the cookies around in the kitchen or whatever your job is. That might save your life. You know, if you don't show up for it, somebody might call you and maybe save your life. The third thing I recommend you do is make a friend, somebody around your own length of sobriety you can talk to and hang out with. My first friend's name is Betty. I told Betty everything before I told it to my sponsor. When you're new, it's nice to hear how stuff's going to sound out loud before you call your sponsor with it, you know, because you might want to tweak the wording a little when you then call her. So I call Betty and say, here's what I'm thinking of doing, or worse, here's what I've done. And sometimes she'd say what I hoped was, oh yeah, sounds cool. But mostly she'd say, oh man, you have to call your sponsor right now. And I tried to be the same kind of friend back at her. And I think it's really, really important. She was sober 3 days less than me. When we were 10 years sober, she went out. And I didn't see her until I was 25 years sober and I was visiting her in prison. So it's not like she went out and had a great time. I believe she is sober today. I heard that she is sober today, and that makes me very happy she is in another state now. But the point I'm making here is, you know, I'm not a better person than Betty or more deserving, or, you know, I used to think alcohol was pretty as her or smart as her. My life would be so much better. As near as I can tell, the only difference between us is is that I've tried to do everything that has been asked of me in Alcoholics Anonymous, whether I wanted to or not. I just do it. You know, I'm not always happy to this day. I'm still not always happy about the things that I have to do. But I do them, and I always, of course, feel better afterwards. You'd think you'd remember that, wouldn't you? You know, when you think, oh, I don't want to have this, and then maybe that's why we keep going to meetings all the time. I don't know. But if you're new, I hope you hear nothing else. You hear this. Alcoholics Anonymous is the best thing that has ever happened to me. I live this incredibly good life today because of it. I feel comfortable and I feel comfortable in my own skin. You know, life is good, and I am very glad to be here. Thank you. Thank you.